From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for May 28th. I'm John Myers from KQED, and at an undisclosed bunker location yet again, Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly. We've got several things to talk about, I guess, about state politics quickly here in our Sacramento to Los Angeles phone line conversation. Budget.
Banning the state.
Yeah, budget, I guess, first of all. Who gets to describe the Assembly Democratic budget proposal?
I can take a whack at it. Essentially, long story short, basically it's a scheme to raise oil taxes on a majority vote and then take the first 20 years of that revenue and use it to plug the holes in this year's budget. That's kind of the essence of the proposal. Now, it goes through this fund, this recycling bottle fund. You don't need to know all that.
Oh, no, let's do that. Let me see if I can do that part. You gave the big picture. Let's see if I can get this part right for people who didn't see it all. So effectively to do this, and I think that we have to say, too, that the reason it is so complicated, I mean, really the primary reason it is so complicated, is because they can't get a Republican vote for a tax increase.
Part of it.
Yeah, but I mean, but because they are striving to do this thing that became a great capital phrase in 2009, a revenue neutral tax increase.
Yeah.
And a revenue neutral tax increase apparently by definition is not a tax increase, and it's revenue neutral. Therefore, it does not require a 2/3 vote to raise a tax.
Subject to legal interpretation.
Exactly right, which may be part of what's going to happen. But because you can't get Republicans to vote for a tax increase, you have to go through this strange machination to get this money, to borrow that money up front to pay the deficit off. So it seems like it goes something like this. You've got if you're going to impose an oil severance tax, which is a key fundamental part of this proposal, if you're going to impose an oil severance tax, you've got to lower a tax somewhere else. And so you end up lowering a tax, a sales tax, that the state collects now, that therefore kind of balances off the numbers there. And then there's also the added benefit when you lower the state sales tax, you get to increase the sales tax collected by local governments, which makes the sales tax a wash for consumers. They're not getting a deal here. They're going to pay the same sales tax.
But it pushes due to the old triple flip.
Yeah, and it pushes money into local governments, which actually supposedly helps them and frees up pressure on the state, which was having to pay some more money out of its general fund for schools and things like that. Whew. Man.
You didn't mention the bottle fund.
Well, because the bottle fund's important, folks, from a policy perspective, because basically what we're doing is we are paying back this 20-year loan from Wall Street investors through the Beverage Recycling Container Fund.
Apparently it's a more reliable stream of revenue than an oil tax because oil production varies so widely. So Wall Street will only front us the money if we secure it with money from our bottle recycling, which will be backfilled by this new oil tax. You got all that?
Got all that.
You and I get it. I don't know if anybody else.
So now, having described all these different moving parts of this thing, let's kind of get to the politics of this, which it's a very interesting move by Democrats in the Assembly. Senate Democrats put out a plan earlier that had really a lot of tax increases in it. This one has a small tax increase, if you call that oil tax a tax increase under that majority vote thingamabob. But it's an interesting strategy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and I think some other developments this week. I mean, one of the things that the Assembly plan has or doesn't have are deep cuts to social services. They essentially take 20 years of this oil tax revenue, about $9 billion, and use that to backfill the cuts that were proposed by Governor Schwarzenegger. In fact, they go above and beyond. They actually make some payments on debts to local governments and schools that the governor's plan did not. And I think politically, I mean, earlier this week we saw the California Teachers Association take out some billboards and send mailers out. I got one at home attacking Senate leader Daryl Steinberg, urging him not to make any more cuts to education. We also, in a Senate race that's very near and dear to Steinberg's heart, He's supporting Assemblywoman Mary Salas down in San Diego. And we saw one of the big union players in town, AFSCME, the federal, state, and municipal employees, put in tens of thousands of dollars into an IE against Steinberg's candidate in support of Juan Vargas, former assemblyman who's running down there. And so politically, I mean, just big picture for a while, so you're seeing some of the unions begin to hammer Steinberg and attack Steinberg. And Perez, this is his first budget as speaker, and his first move out of the gate is to propose a plan that doesn't have any of the cuts that the governor proposed. And so politically, I mean, I think it's a way of rallying support for some of the Democratic, of the core Democratic constituencies behind the new speaker and behind the assembly.
You know, I think the thing about the union criticism over Senator Steinberg is interesting, because if you go back and look at that 2009 budget deal, one could argue there were some deep cuts there, especially in education. Some could also argue, though, that it could have been a lot worse. And so, this is an interesting line of attack from a powerful interest group or interest groups against their allies in the legislature. I mean, compared to the governor and Republicans.
And they want to have a conversation about the budget process, and about revenues. I mean, keep in mind, both of these groups, both CTA and AFSCME, CTA has a ballot measure on the November ballot, we think it's going to be on the November ballot, that would suspend some of these corporate tax cuts that are scheduled to go into effect in the new fiscal year. And then AFSCME has given money to this measure that both Steinberg and Perez support to reduce the vote threshold for the budget to a majority vote. Both those initiatives have submitted their signatures, and so I think that's part of the atmospherics for this. You know, you've got this budget, which could extend, I mean, potentially into campaign season if the two sides don't come together. And right now, it doesn't look like there's much movement on any of, I don't know, the four sides, the five sides. I don't know how you would characterize how many dimensions or size this budget fight has at this point.
Dimensions, sides, you know, some kind of appropriate comparison. But you know, the other one that you didn't mention on that list too, that I think is, you know, that we've got to talk about, is that majority vote budget ballot measure.
Sorry.
No, I was listening, but I got to tell people who are listening to the podcast, I'm also trying to monitor the audio here, making sure that we get perceptible audio in this podcast from the phone line.
It'll still be indecipherable because I'm blathering on about, you know, God knows what.
Don't worry about that. But I want to go back to the majority vote one. Yes, you did mention it. Thank you. But I want to go back to it because, I mean, there's also a danger there for Republicans about holding out too long on a budget, because if they, you know, that strengthens the hand, you would think, of backers of a majority vote. If we have a long budget delay into the summer, you know, that voters may say, yeah, let's change that requirement. And then Republicans, right, if they lose that at the ballot in November, they've lost one of the biggest things they have in power in the Capitol.
It's the budget has become the major point of leverage for all policy decisions. I mean, it's the one place in the process where Republicans actually have leverage and over policy decisions. Policy has been folded in to the budget process because the Democratic majorities run roughshod over Republicans otherwise. So it's a huge concern. That's why you're seeing, even though the two-thirds vote threshold would not apply to taxes, a lot of Republicans are opposing the majority vote budget package because it reduces or eliminates one of the few leverage points they have in the legislative process.
You know, and going back to the budget proposal that Assembly Speaker Perez put on the table this week, what I find interesting, too, is that, you know, we all know that all of the proposals so far, the governor's May revision, the Senate Democratic version, which has a lot of taxes in it, relatively a lot of taxes compared to anything else now, and the Assembly Democratic version, which has only that one tax, though they don't call it a tax, and the borrowing. You look at the borrowing plan, though, out of the Assembly Democratic package, that's about an $8 billion amount of money they want to get over, you know, from Wall Street investors. And as you said, Anthony, you know, that there aren't a lot of deep cuts to social programs in the Assembly version. Right. One might guess that if there was a compromise somewhere down the road, you could find willingness to do some kind of, perhaps, I mean, I don't know this from talking to people in the building, you could find some kind of willingness to do some kind of borrowing plan, either for less in addition, you know, in exchange for some cuts, or you could use the money in some other places. I mean, we might have seen a key element to a final budget package because there's flexibility in the amount of money and the way you get it.
And I agree with you. I mean, the mechanism might actually be key for the budget end game, but just how you spend the revenues might be different. I mean, look, using 20 years worth of revenues from this tax to fill a one-year hole in the budget and make no changes, and that a hole that will be just as large next year as it is this year because you're not making any structural changes, that concept probably isn't going to fly. But could the revenue-generating mechanism work? Potentially, yeah. I mean, but like you said, Democrats might have to give on some cuts and maybe some other structural reforms that the governor and other folks have called for, so that you're not sort of using all 20 years of this oil tax revenue just to plug holes in the budget for this year and find yourself in the exact same spot come January. So that was definitely my feeling and my sense when I saw the plan and heard about it. And then there's sort of, you kind of have to separate it out into two different things. Number one is the proposal, the mechanics for how you generate the revenue, and then the other side is how you spend it. And I think that it does sort of it changes the conversation a little bit about the budget going forward and provides some potential clues about what the budget endgame might be. Although the governor dismissed it out of hand.
And the only other thing I would say on this is that this was a creation of budget staffers in the assembly with Assembly Speaker Perez, and on Friday the speaker was on our public affairs show Forum on KQED, and he was being interviewed and was talking about lots of things. But before the interview, he was here in our studio across the street from the state capitol, and I was talking to him about this plan and asking him kind of what he thought the reaction had been through the week. And his comment was, he thought he'd gotten lots of great feedback and positive reception in different people around the state, except in the press, where he thought the reaction was a little more cynical and skeptical. And my message back to him was because I think that people in the press, reporters and columnists and others, have seen so many of the so-called third way options around the real fundamental cuts, taxes, dilemma that you have to balance budgets. You know, we've seen so many things that have been either called creative or gimmicks. And so it's difficult not to see this as yet another one, even though it may be more substantive or it may be more serious or real or viable. I'll let somebody else decide that. But you know what I mean, Anthony? I mean, we've seen a lot of this. And so it's very difficult as reporters to not go, yet another thing that's not one of the real things you do to balance budgets.
Well, and I think that's just it. And sort of getting back to sort of separating this out between the mechanism and how you spend the revenues. Look, you're taking 20 years worth of revenues and spending it for
1 year.
For 1 year, and you're not making any of the hard decisions and the structural reforms, either increasing revenues or reducing costs to solve the budget crisis going forward. And so, I'll plead guilty to aforementioned cynicism about it, mostly because of the way that, not so much because of the mechanism itself, but because of the way that the Assembly Democrats elected to spend the revenue. That does nothing to solve the budget crisis going forward. And I think that if there is cynicism about it, that's why. I mean, look, it sounds great. You've found a way to balance the budget, right, this year's budget, without making any deep cuts. And I love it. Every year there's a new term of art. I think we heard Assemblyman Bob Blumenfeld, the chair of the Budget Committee, use the phrase, no broad-based tax increases, right? This was the new qualifier. It wasn't that there were no tax increases, it's that they were not broad-based tax increases. That means just the oil companies are going to pay them. It's clever, and it it might even be good policy. I mean, I don't know. You can argue about that, but what doesn't seem to be good policy is using 20 years worth of that money just to plug 1 year's hole and then finding yourself in the same hole come January. That's the frustration of the budget process. That's the sort of Groundhog's Day scenario that those of us who've covered this for a few years, come back to time and time again. And I think anticipation of next year is sort of the root of some of that cynicism. You know, Speaker Perez and Assembly Democrats would say, well, you know, first thing you have to do is just stop digging yourself into a hole. Well, okay, but you can make the argument that this digs the hole deeper.
Yeah, it depends on what kind of hole you're talking about, right?
Well, right, because this takes one of the revenue options, you know, the oil severance tax, completely off the table for the next 20 years because you've already exhausted it and spent it just to plug the holes in the 2010-11 budget. So is it the top kill solution for the budget? No, it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't do much to solve the long-term problem.
Did I just hear you appropriate the term top kill from the Gulf oil
you like
spill
that?
For the budget?
You like that?
We'll see whether the podcast audience liked that or not. So let's quickly let's talk about, since we're talking about things that would be around next year or problems, let's talk about who might be governor next year just quickly because, yeah, it's my segue. Just because we want to talk just very briefly about, we got some campaign finance data this week that gives us a bigger picture than the daily filings of who's giving money, a bigger picture of how money is being spent. And I don't think there's going to be anybody shocked when we say it's an unbelievable amount of money being spent by these campaigns, being led by one campaign, the campaign of Meg Whitman, that reported she has spent $61 million this year and more than half of that just in the last 2 months.
Yeah, and that doesn't even mention the money that she spent before, right, in 2009. That's, last year was 2009, right?
It was, I believe.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, she's over the last, 2 months, she's spent about $500,000 a day. Was it $33 million? Was that the number? 33.8?
Yeah.
Was that it? And Steve Poizner has spent a little more than half that. And Jerry Brown spent $1.25 or something.
I think Brown's expenses for all of 2010 so far are about $400,000, also known as, right, less than what Meg Whitman has spent in one day. It doesn't seem to change any of that discussion about the campaign and money and any of that. I mean, I guess it shouldn't be surprising to any of us in some ways.
No, I think there's sort of a numbness that sets in. I mean, you know, we've seen PG&E now has spent, you know, close to $50 million on Proposition 16. I mean, the dollars that are being spent on California campaigns, I think at some point you get desensitized. You know, we've talked before about whether the spending is eventually going to be a problem for Meg Whitman. You know, I don't know. I mean, Steve Poizner has tried to make that case that Whitman's trying to buy the election, although, you know, Poizner hasn't exactly been a pauper. I mean, he's spent you know, millions of dollars of his own money.
About $24 million so far, yeah.
Yeah. And if Meg Whitman wasn't in this race, we'd be talking about how much money Steve Poizner has been spending or is willing to spend. You know, in 2006, we saw Steve Westley, a Democrat, spend almost $50 million of his own money. So that was also eBay money, incidentally. I don't know if there's...
Well, and you know, the other thing that I think is interesting is that, I mean, and it doesn't mean a lot. It's just an odd observation, especially when you talk about that we're kind of numb to the money, is that, you know, should it be Meg Whitman versus Jerry Brown in the fall? We're very getting close to where we're going to not keep saying, you know, if it is, but we'll know for sure who it is, Meg Whitman or Steve Poizner. But if you look at what Brown has on hand, he reported about $20 million of cash on hand. That used to be a lot of money. That used to be like a pretty good war chest going into a fall campaign at this point. And it somehow almost reflects that very strange dynamic of a candidate who has a long track record and you know, kind of harkens images of politics of days gone by versus a candidate who's living in a very different world of spending all of this money. You know, Jerry Brown with $20 million, Meg Whitman could spend $20 million without blinking it with an eye. And so, you know, it's, who knows? Come June 9th, we're going to have an interesting discussion about where the candidates stand, not just on the issues, but about how they are going to effectively manage money and message and a campaign operation for the fall.
And it's also the calendar. I mean, it used to be after a June primary, you would sort of, the campaign would lie fallow for a couple of months and kind of really reignite for real after Labor Day. That's not going to happen. I mean, we're going to have a five months of solid campaigning. And this week, again, we're hearing claims from labor unions and other groups loyal to Jerry Brown to be on the air with campaign commercials to not cede the summer to Meg Whitman. and to try to fill that gap. Now, you know, to be on the air in June and July and August, and so that Brown can continue to husband his resources and save them for sort of the final 8 weeks of the campaign. And so you could have a situation, and I think you will have a situation, where the independent expenditures in this race, certainly on the Democratic side, end up outspending the actual candidate probably 2-1. And that's just, that's a function, I think, some of it because of the campaign finance laws, but also just the fact that Meg Whitman, as a candidate, just has the resources the likes of which we have just never seen. No candidate has spent this kind of money on their own campaign.
And we're going to obviously have to talk about the campaign more next week, because we're going to see some more polling. And,
we are.
We'll get a sense of that. And I think, you know, when some of that polling's going to come out, some of it's going to come out soon, isn't it, Anthony?
Yes. Yes, I'm affiliated with two publications that might have some polling out soon.
So. Two?
We'll see.
Oh, well, then there's even more of a preview. That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.